Good morning, church. So great to be with you again. Thank you for being here. Thank you for singing out so well and for edifying and encouraging all of us. Thank you for the thoughts surrounding the supper and the encouragement that brings, for the prayers. Just been a good day. We're thankful for it. We're thankful to have visitors among us once again, and we are just so delighted that you are here. What passage am I trying to find? 2 John is where I'm trying to go, and somehow I'm trying to make that one of Paul's letters. 2 John is where we will be today. Notice I said 2 John is where we will be today, which means what? We finished 1 John. And you didn't think we were ever going to do that, and we did. And so we are moving on. Now we can truly claim that our theme has been love letters from John.
Because now we're on our second one, right? We're in the
plural stage. So excited about that. 2 John, if you have studied 2 John in the last 12 months, raise your hand. 24 months. Are you being truthful? He's read it. He read it. He got that far in his daily Bible program one time. Last 36, we don't study 2 John, do we? We, as I've already demonstrated, have trouble finding 2 John. Sometimes, because it's just not one of those letters that we focus on all that much. It's 13 verses. What does 2 John chapter 2 verse 1 say? There isn't one. It's just a very short, very personal letter, and certainly worthy of our consideration. Not going to take us that long. 2 John chapter 1, verse 1. The elder to the chosen lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, for the sake of the truth
which abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and love.
I was very glad to find some of your children walking in truth, just as we have received commandment
to do from the Father.
Now I ask you, lady, not as though I were writing to you
a new
commandment, but the one which we have heard from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to His commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning,
that you should walk
in it. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do
not acknowledge Jesus Christ
as coming in the
flesh.
This is the
deceiver and the antichrist.
Watch
yourselves, that you do not
lose what we have accomplished,
but
that you may receive a full reward. Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching, he has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting. For the one who gives him a greeting
participates
in his evil deeds. Though I have many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak face to face, so that your joy may be made full. The children of your chosen sister greet you. This letter is very personal to John.
The former letter had more
of a tone generality to it. This is a letter that John probably had a lot of different Christians Christians in his mind from a lot of different places. He's writing this letter, and he wants it to go out, and he wants it to be an encouragement to everybody who might get their hands on a copy of this thing. This letter seems to be more personal. And there's a lot of discussion about whether this is a real lady. This is a woman, a specific woman that John is writing to, or whether he's using that in a figurative sense to describe a particular congregation. I see evidence that supports both sides of that, so we're not really going to spend our time trying to figure out which one of those is true. I think they both could be true. But John has, I think, if it is a church, he has a very specific church in mind. He's writing a very personal letter, a letter to someone that he hopes, at the end of the letter, he will see them face to face very, very shortly. See, this is my that I would like to receive, right? Because you send me 13 verses, I got no problems reading that. You send me 1 Corinthians, and it's going to take me a minute. It's going to take me a minute to work through it. But this letter is the kind of letter I like to receive. That letter says, I'm going to come see you soon, and we're going to sit down face to face in the same room, and we're going to talk. I got a lot of things to tell, a lot of things to share with you. But we're going to do it face to face. I don't want to have to just write about it. I want to meet with you and sit across the table.
And let's encourage each other in person. I want to make a mention just really quickly of verse 3.
In just about every letter that we see in the New Testament, we see concepts being addressed either at the beginning of the letter or at the end of the letter. Two concepts that are kind of thrown out there, and it's a kind of a wish or a prayer that the author is offering on behalf of the audience to whom he's writing. And those two concepts are grace and peace. Grace and peace. Paul's letters, and it's grace and peace, grace and peace. Even Peter gets in on that. Grace and peace be to you. Those two concepts are mentioned in just about every New Testament letter
where the author is asking for that
to be given to his audience. On a couple of occasions, the Apostle Paul will add the concept of mercy into the mix. And in the cases where he does that are to the letters that he writes to Timothy and to Titus. And so I've kind of always thought about this. I don't know if there's really anything to it, but I've always kind of thought about, why would he include mercy into those letters, to those two individuals? Well, in those particular, he's not writing to churches, he's writing to preachers. And he is adding in, and particularly he's writing to young preachers. And young people, well, they need grace and they need peace. But what do young people do? And no offense to any young people, and you can decide whether you're in that category or not. To you or not, but everybody else can decide whether they are in that category or not. What do young people do
from time to time? They make mistakes. They make mistakes. And when you
think about grace versus mercy, you know, the simplest way that it's ever been described to me,
and it's kind of the definitions that have stuck with me over the years.
Grace is when you receive something from someone
that you do not deserve.
You don't deserve it, and you were granted that anyway. You were in the grace of the Lord when you didn't deserve salvation, and He provided a way for you to have it anyway.
That is God's grace.
Mercy is kind of on the other side of that coin. You did do something, and you do deserve punishment. You are about to reap what you have sown, and yet mercy sweeps in and holds back that which you do deserve.
So on one side, you're being given a gift you don't deserve.
On the other side, the gift is that you did not receive a punishment or a consequence that you absolutely deserve. And I think it's interesting that John adds that concept here as well, and especially when he's going to be, in this first part of the letter at least, talking about the little children who are walking in the Lord, and those young people who he is kind of praying a prayer of grace, yes, peace, yes, but also mercy to be upon them. I just thought that was interesting. Looking at that years ago and kind of noticing that it's always the two, or at least in most cases, in most of the letters.
But then every once
in a while you'll see a writer include mercy in that prayer. He's overjoyed
at what he's hearing.
We don't really know where he is
or
who he's actually writing to, but he likes what he's hearing about them. He
understands
that if this is a specific person, that her and her family are doing well. They are walking in the Lord.
If this is a specific church, he's
thinking and thanking God for what he's hearing about how they are walking in the faith. He says, I'm glad to find some of your children walking in the
truth.
And this is a repeat, right? We're not going to necessarily dwell and focus on this as much as we have in the past, but this is a repeat, almost word for word, from what he said back in the first letter. About, it's not a new commandment, it's an old commandment, it's a commandment we've had from the beginning. This goes back to what Jesus talked to his disciples about how they, he's not writing a new commandment, but he's not giving them a new commandment, but he is giving them a new commandment, and the newness of it was that now we have a model of what it looks like. Right? Had the people of God been commanded since the very beginning to love one another, to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love their neighbor as themselves? Yes,
that had
been around verbally since the time of Moses, but certainly implied from the very beginning of time. Because when Cain killed Abel, what's he guilty of? Not loving his brother,
right?
And so this commandment has been around since the very beginning of time. But when Jesus arrived on the scene, what makes it new is, as I have loved you, you also go and love one another. So now we don't just have a command to follow. Now we have an example of what it looks like to love one another in that way. This is what I meant when I said, love your neighbor as yourself. As I have loved you, so you also ought to love one another. John heard that. He heard it come out of the mouth of Jesus, and he is going tell everybody about what he has heard come out of the mouth of Jesus. And so he spent a great deal of time looking at this concept in his first letter. Now he's reviewing that in the second letter. The command from the beginning that we ought to love one another. And this is the love that we should walk in. This is the keeping of his commandment.
Reasons
why there is this love that is necessary is because there are many opponents.
There are many opponents to
walking in the light of the Lord. And he's going to spend the next paragraph basically
talking about those people
who are against us. The deceivers that have gone out into the world. And we talked about this in our Bible class, so those of you that were in there, sorry for a second helping of that, but this idea of why is it so important that we love one another? Why is it so important that we stick together? Why should our love for each other be built up to be as strong as it can possibly be? Because we have enemies. We have
common enemies.
Enemies who want to destroy us. We have one ultimate enemy who is directing all of the other enemies, and his goal is plain and simple: to destroy you, to devour you, to keep you eternally separated from God. That's his goal. And guess what? He's good at his job. Really good at his job. He knows how to
get to us.
He understands what it's not like we're keeping any secrets about what makes us weak and vulnerable. We advertise that stuff pretty clearly. He doesn't have to search for it too hard because we are pretty obvious in the things that make us stumble and fall. And so there are many opponents
that are out there.
In the book of
Philippians, what we talked about
in our class
this morning,
there's this concept
of Paul wanting the Philippians to stand fast,
to kind of be immovable, and to strive to be of one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And
it's this kind of
building up of this oneness, this team mentality. It's us against everybody else. Have you ever seen
a team that was like that? Whatever the context was, it could be a math
bowl team, it could be a team of nerds, it could be a pickleball team. I mean, you know, you don't want to go against Ethan and Kelly in pickleball, all right? Because they're a team, and they're gonna destroy you in that game. And so you see a team that has this mentality that it is us
against the world.
There's many opponents out there, many people who want to look at us and criticize us, but it's us against everybody else. Those are the teams
that may not be successful in the way that we define
success. They may not win the championship.
They may not
win the game. But the fact that they are a team means that they've understood the assignment. They've understood the assignment. I don't remember who the quote is attributed to. I think I've probably heard it attributed to many different coaches over the years. But the quote goes something like this, at least the concept I have down, is that
I'll know
that my team is ready when they
have one heartbeat.
And there is nothing that finds oneness more than having one singular heartbeat. You remember the
story
I don't remember what year it was. It was before
I was born.
You could tell me. What
year did
the U.S. beat Russia in hockey? It's kind of a big deal. 1980. So I wasn't even in the womb yet. I'm sorry, I just wasn't there. So it was a long time ago because I'm old now. But There's a movie made about that, and I think this part of the story is true. They had gotten embarrassed prior to the actual Olympic Games, and they spent a long time on the ice after a really disappointing and embarrassing loss, and he was making them do sprints on the ice, and every so often he would ask them the question, "What's your name? What team do you play for?" And every single time the athlete would respond his name and the college team that he played for. "I play for the University of Minnesota. I play for the University or Boston University. And so he would make them do more sprints. And then finally, one of them, put him on the line one more time to go even harder. A young man speaks up and says his name, and the coach says, "What team do you play for?" And he said, "I play for the United States of America." And at that point, a group of individuals who all went to different colleges, who saw themselves as enemies prior to them coming together to make this team,
they now understood
that they were one team. Not a collection of individuals who needed to
maintain their own identity within the team.
And that is what made that team strong and gave them probably the ability to go out and do something that was unbelievable, described as a miracle in the sport of hockey. That's the concept that John is describing here.
And the reason
why John is describing this concept is this is the concept that Jesus prayed for.
Were you looking, were you listening, were you reading along
when Robbie read to us just a moment ago?
Some of the final words of Jesus
before he went to the garden and prayed that he was going to do the Father's will, whatever that was. The final words of his prayer among his disciples before he went out to that place was about the unity of
believers, about the fact
that we should be one, just like God is one with Jesus.
That's the level of
unity that he wants. And the reason why is because the opposition is great. There are many deceivers that have gone out into the world. And in this particular case, and
just like we mentioned in
1 John, Paul had to deal with the teaching of circumcision, right? Many of Paul's letters, almost all of them, have some aspect where he's having to address the fact that there were people who came along behind him who tried to upset the faith of those who had accepted the gospel, specifically the Gentiles, and teach them that in some way they weren't really followers of Jesus. They weren't really blood-bought citizens of the kingdom of God yet because they had not obeyed the law of Moses.
They had not
been circumcised in their flesh. That's kind of the false teaching of the day that Paul had to deal with. John is specifically dealing with a different kind of false teaching. It has nothing to do with the flesh. In fact, it has to do with the idea that the flesh is inherently evil. That if you are flesh, you are by nature evil. And so Jesus couldn't be the perfect Lamb of God, the perfect sacrifice for sins, if he came in the flesh, because if he was flesh, then he was evil. And they got to this conclusion by thinking that they were really wise, thinking that they were knowledgeable. And we get that word knowledge, knowledgeable, from this
word that they called
themselves, the Gnostics. Wisdom, learning. We understand things better than anyone else. And what conclusion that led them to was that Jesus didn't actually come in the flesh, that there's no way he could have done that because if he was flesh, he was evil. And John says, you can't entertain this thought for a second. You can't even walk by somebody in the marketplace who is spreading this and say hello to them. That in and of itself gives some measure of credence to what he is proclaiming to be true, which is dangerous, and we've got to avoid that. Don't invite that person to come
into your home. Don't break bread with that
person. Don't share a meal with that person. To do that would be to truly support and give credence to the teaching that is being espoused here. Now, I asked you, when was the last time you studied 2 John? And we got one guy who read it, he thinks, maybe, in the last 2 years. And we don't study it. Where do we see it come up? Or at least this is my experience. Your experience may be different.
At
this letter
comes up sometimes,
not because of the love one another side of the letter. In my Bible, it's two columns, and this is kind of the love one another side, and this is the reject evil and reject false teaching side, right? So most of the time when you hear 1
John
brought up, it's not because of the love one another side. It's here's how we have permission to treat people who are false teachers. We have permission to not greet them, not invite them into our home, not sit down at the same table with them.
And what
it grows to is something beyond Gnosticism and those who are denying that Jesus ever came in the flesh and not allowing that teaching to spread. And what it morphs into is, anybody that I disagree with on any point of spiritual discussion, if I greet them, if I certainly sit down and break bread with them, I've now committed some great sin, some great travesty. And if that was all of our attitude about everything, we'd eat alone a lot. We would eat alone all the time. And it's the, you know, to me, the love one another side of this letter should spill over into the avoid false teaching side of this letter.
And
show the overwhelming love that should inspire us to want to go out and have these discussions, to sit down and talk about areas in our lives where we might disagree. Have you ever, maybe your conversion story includes something like this. Someone who never, you know, never would have been in the same place as you, never in your neighborhood, on your side of the tracks. Somebody stepped out of their comfort zone to reach across the aisle or across the table to invite you to come and sit and talk, learn, and be pointed to the Father. That's the goal, right? Is to point people to the Father. Somebody, maybe it was your parents, but maybe not. Maybe it was somebody who just came along and saw that you were suffering
in a life without the Father, and they took the time
and loved you enough to love one another
side,
spilled over into the I disagree with your lifestyle side, and caused them to step out and say, I'd like to introduce you to the Father. We can't let a passage like this that talks about Don't have them in your home. Don't extend them a greeting. I think there is a specific
false teaching
that John is dealing with here and saying this has to be stopped. It can't be entertained. It can't be given a single moment's consideration. Because that teaching is that
dangerous.
Not everything that we disagree on
is that
dangerous.
And so the love
side has to spill over and say, let's sit down and talk about it.
Let me
show you what I understand to be truth, what I perceive to be the way to the Father. And let's sit down and discuss it. We clearly are on
different pages here with this topic or
this concept. Let's reason. Let's reason together. We've
somewhat
lost our ability to reason with one another. When's the last time you saw somebody comment on a social media post and say, you know what, you're right, I've changed my mind. You've convinced me that I was wrong.
No. We
double down in those things, don't we? It's like, oh, you've challenged me? Let me just come back at you with something that's even more bold and hard. We've kind of lost the ability as human beings to just sit down and reason with one another. And out of respect for one another as human beings to consider how we might strive together as one mind for the furtherance of the gospel, to strive together to try to become exactly what
Jesus
prayed for prior to going to the garden where he was going to be taken and caused to suffer by the will of God, that we work together to try to fulfill that prayer, to try to
make that prayer a
reality, that we would be one team with one heartbeat, which doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to agree on every single point, but we can still do that and be one
team standing against all of the opponents that are out there.
Father in heaven, thank you so much for this day, and thank you for the words of your servant John. We would have loved to have been a part of that conversation where he was able to sit down face to face with those who he's writing to, be able to tell them all the things that he had to share. We're thankful for what has been shared, thankful that it has been preserved for us. We're thankful, Father, that you
can remind us
of your will for us,